of international political forces to impose pressure on Yemenis.
The United Nations warned that the shortage of funds will hamper the assistance it provides to 13 million Yemenis, including thousands of children suffering from acute malnutrition.
The announcement by the World Food Programme to reduce food aid provided to 8 million people is to continue to blackmail the Yemeni people and the political leadership and pressure them to yield more and make more concessions in favor of the coalition of aggression. And unfortunately, the international community is complicit in this aggression. This act will cause a major humanitarian catastrophe since the aid reaches only a very small number of people and most of the money earned by international organizations goes to operate expenses of the organizations themselves and not to the needy.
Since the beginning of the Saudi-led war on Yemen in 2015, millions of Yemenis have been depending on humanitarian assistance to survive. The United Nations describes Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
Observers say the lives of millions of Yemenis remain in danger unless the international community takes real measures to pressure Saudi Arabia to lift the siege it imposes on Yemen. Despite ongoing humanitarian assistance, the world body says 16.2 million people in Yemen remain food insecure. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
President Vladimir Putin has talked about Moscow's security proposals presented to the NATO alliance last week. Speaking during his annual press conference, he said it is the Western countries that must immediately give Russia security guarantees, not the other way around.
They told us in the 1990s, not an inch to the east. What is the result? They cheated us. They simply impudently cheated us with NATO's five waves of expansion. Now the corresponding systems are already appearing in Romania and Poland. Have we approached the borders of the US or Britain? They have approached ours, and now they say Ukraine will also be a NATO member.
Prominent Russian journalists who have worked in the presidential pool for 20 years believe that Putin's statements serve as a deterrent against the West.
It seems to me that he should not be fascinated by anything for a long time, but he himself sets the vector of many agreements, follows a path that is sometimes completely unexpected for many, hinting that if it is ignored, then retaliatory actions will follow. And since no one knows what they can be, they start to get scared. This is a deterrent.
Speaking about Ukraine, Putin said that Russia was responding to threats from Kyiv. He said Kyiv does not want to honor the Minsk agreements and adopts laws that run counter to these accords. Putin said Ukraine and the West want to portray Russia as a party of the conflict in that country. He said incumbent Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has been under the influence of radical elements after coming to power, like the country's previous leaders.
There must be tension for the hegemon to change. The hegemon, which is America and the English-speaking world, will not just give itself up. But this hegemon does not have enough strength, and we are watching it trying to enter into negotiations.
On Afghanistan, Putin stated that Afghanistan needs a government that represents its entire people so it can be recognized by the international community. He asserted that the countries that occupied Afghanistan for two decades should be the first to offer aid. He called on the West to unfreeze Afghanistan's financial assets, warning that the country is on the brink of famine.
Putin holds a big press conference every year in December, during which the president often touches on acute international problems and suggests ways to solve them. The statements made by the Russian president during this event are prompted by politicians from different countries, in particular by the opponents of Russia. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
A show of Iranian military might and Israeli saber-rattling, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps fired 16 ballistic missiles and a fitting conclusion to its latest exercises. The IRGC confirmed that the missile hit and destroyed their intended targets with 100% accuracy. Five-day drills, dubbed Great Prophet 17, also featured a variety of combat and reconnaissance drones, sophisticated ballistic and cruise missiles, and attack helicopters. Advanced homegrown tank dubbed Karar also debuted in the exercises. The joint maneuvers involved IRGC's ground, naval, and aerospace divisions and spanned over Iran's southern coastline almost entirely, including Hormozgan, Bushehr, and Khuzestan provinces. The Persian Gulf and the Strait of Hormuz provided the maritime setting for Iranian forces to show their might. Iran regularly holds military exercises to maintain its combat readiness and deter any act of aggression. It says the maneuvers carry a message of peace and security for its neighbors and friendly countries. But this time around, the drills carried greater significance amid escalating anti-Iran rhetoric by Israel. The IRGC chief did not mince his words, describing the exercises as an authentic warning to Israel.
These maneuvers, particularly today's exercises, carried a very clear and explicit message, and that's a serious, real, and battlefield warning to the Zionist regime's officials, who have repeatedly issued anti-Iran threats, to beware of their mistakes and errors. In case of a misstep by them, we will cut off their hands.
General Salami stressed that all it takes to turn the drills into an actual military campaign is readjusting the direction the missiles are fired in. Israel and its main backer, the U.S., have repeatedly and overtly in recent weeks warned of a military offensive against the Islamic Republic, despite the ongoing talks in Vienna to revive the 2015 Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action after the U.S. unilateral withdrawal, with Israeli President Isaac Herzog saying that Iran's nuclear program must be neutralized once and for all, with or without an agreement. It's widely believed that such threats lack credibility and serve as a mere leverage to extract concessions from Iran around the negotiating table. The Iranian negotiators, however, can confidently and nonchalantly stand their ground with such display of military prowess and deterrence backing them up.
We're visiting Afghanistan's largest children's hospital in Kabul. These days, the hospital is receiving malnourished babies more than any time before. Doctors here say malnutrition has increased since the poverty is on the rise in Afghanistan, adding the hospital lacks beds and medicines.
The patients in our malnutrition wards have recently increased. There aren't enough rooms for them. Sometimes we have to place more than one patient on an individual bed. If the ongoing shortage of food and nutrition continues, more and more children will face malnutrition.
World countries should help Afghan malnourished mothers and children. It's obvious to all what's going on in Afghanistan. Our breadwinners are jobless as winter bites. Children and mothers are being malnourished as food is not brought to table.
According to UNICEF, 3.2 million children under the age of 5 are expected to suffer from acute malnutrition by the end of the year. Authorities say world countries should not leave Afghan children alone.
Definitely, our hospital has been suffering from bad impacts of U.S. sanctions. The U.S. has seized what belongs to Afghan innocent people, and it is a cruel attempt. I demand the international community send their humanitarian aid to Afghan people today, as they used to help our nation under the previous government.
Following the Taliban took over of the country, international funding to the Afghan people were cut off, and billions of dollars in Afghan assets were frozen by the U.S.
The war may be over in Afghanistan, but the nation now is struggling with an economic crisis. Half of the population of Afghanistan is facing acute hunger, and over 1 million Afghan children are at risk of dying. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Turkish lira gained 20% on Monday following a speech by President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. The recovery followed a series of decisions announced by the president in a presser after the cabinet meeting. He said the new measures will encourage Turks to keep their savings in local currency instead of exchanging it to US dollar and euro.
We are presenting a new financial alternative to citizens who want to alleviate their concerns stemming from the rise in exchange rates when they evaluate their savings. Investors will be encouraged to move towards Turkish lira-based assets by issuance of government bills that are indexed to public economic enterprise revenues that are transferred to the budget.
Erdogan also said the Turkish government will help exporters who find it difficult to present the prices in foreign exchange rates due to fluctuation. He said that the government goes ahead with its lower interest rates plan as promised. The Turkish lira was at 18.4 against the US dollar before the president's speech and stood at 11.3 after it. The lira gaining value rapidly forced people to exchange the U.S. dollar they had into Turkish lira in fear that the rate will go further down. However, the lira lost some of this value Tuesday morning and stood at 13.4 against the U.S. dollar. No one here expected Erdogan's speech to have such an impact. Despite the wild swings, the lira is still down more than 40% against the dollar year to date. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres landed in Beirut on Sunday to follow up several issues, including Lebanon's economic crisis. In a press conference, he described as saddening and heartbreaking the situation in Lebanon.
I am also gravely concerned about the impact of the economic and financial crisis in the country, causing ever more people to need humanitarian assistance. Yesterday, I visited Tripoli in North Lebanon, and today Tyre in the south. And I was very moved when listening to first-hand testimonies of how the crisis is impacting people's daily lives.
During his visit, the United Nations chief met President Michel Aoun and stressed that the United Nations stands in solidarity with Lebanon in its crisis. After meeting with Speaker Nabih Berri, the head of the UN recognized the Israeli violations of Lebanon's airspace.
The opportunity to discuss the presence of UNIFIL in southern Lebanon, the need to end with all violations of the ceasefire, and in particular, the speaker has drawn my attention to the violations of the airspace of Lebanon, and also the need for total implementation of the resolutions of the Security Council.
The UN chief called on the Lebanese political leaders to show unity in order to carry out fundamental reforms and continue talks with the International Monetary Fund. Analysts question whether the UN can have any tangible impact on the situation in Lebanon in light of U.S. sanctions and Israeli violations.
The question we need to ask today is, can the UN change the reality on the ground, especially since there are U.S. economic sanctions and there are daily Israeli violations against Lebanon? Up until now, we have not seen any practical measures from the UN to at least stop these violations and the injustice which the Lebanese people are subject to because of its support for the resistance and its fight to have full sovereignty over its country.
Guterres also visited Prime Minister Najib Mikati and lauded Lebanon's generosity in being a place where Syrians and Palestinians took refuge. The United Nations chief urged the international community to provide more financial assistance to Lebanon, which is grappling with a myriad of crises, especially an unprecedented economic collapse. Yet most Lebanese doubt that these words would be translated into measures to stop U.S. sanctions against Lebanon. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrors fall low in awe of Him. faces are humbled in fear of him, and everything mighty yields to his mightiness. So to thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may his blessings be upon his messenger endlessly, and his salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for thee. I ask thee concerning the complaints of thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among thy servants, of a handmaid from among thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask thee, O he who owns all objects of need, which are granted by his will and hastened to his desire, that thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that thou willst, and givest me mercy from thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee: the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to the Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashmi. Thanks so much for being with us. More extremist calls to kill Muslims in India. This time a video surfaced on social media, even with Hindu religious leaders calling for their people to arm themselves and kill Muslims. Now, of course, there are extremist elements all over the world, but the fact that the ruling leaders, including Prime Minister Narendra Modi, remain silent during this racist and extremist call says a lot. Since Modi has taken over the country in 2014 as prime minister, India has turned from an ethnically diverse society to one of less tolerant and increased violence. But why? What's the goal? Stay with us on this Spotlight.
Panic is on the rise among minorities, particularly Muslims in India. While one can be arrested, threatened, or intimidated for even criticizing the majority, threats against the minorities with vicious hate speeches and ferocious social media campaigns hardly face the course of law. In recent weeks, several far-right groups with ties to the ruling party have called for ethnic cleansing of minorities, especially the country's Muslims.
Slowly, they are moving towards their target, that is to make India as a fascist country. Unfortunately, the secular parties in India, they are weak, they are not united, they don't pose any challenge to the Hindutva element.
A three-day religious event, which was held in the northern Indian city of Hyderabad from 17 to 19 December, faced a tremendous backlash on social and political domains. The event witnessed a dramatic quantity of hate speeches, mobilization threats, and violence against Muslims. Local media reports say some ruling party members also attended the event. Critics say these groups are operating and functioning with a strong political patronage.
Government is trying an agenda which imposed on the Hindutva. They are trying to turn this country into the Hindutva country. And we will never ever allow this government to turn into the Hindutva. We will fight for this democratic right.
They are picking such issues intentionally during elections, and Muslims have always been soft target. Sometimes it's the eating habits of Muslims, sometimes their religious affairs.
While Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi boasts about democracy in India, critics accuse the ruling party of failing to stop violence against the minorities. Since the emergence of ruling BJP in 2014, anti-Muslim sentiments have been on the rise. A police case has been registered to investigate the matter, but there is no arrest yet. Rights activists say there is a less chance of any action by the administration considering the earlier incidents. They say if not addressed in accordance with the rule of the law, it could tear apart social harmony in a diverse country like India, which has a remarkable history of communal violence. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Well, I'd like to welcome my guests to the spotlight, Director of Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, Zafar Bangash, out of Toronto. And the Chairman of Islamic Human Rights Commission, Masood Shajare, out of Qeshm.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome both of you to the program. Well, I'd like to start this off with Zafar. Thanks so much again for being with us. Do you think that the ruling party, BJP party, is specifically targeting Muslims? And if so, why would that be the case?
Absolutely. The ruling party's origins, and particularly those of Narendra Modi, are from a group called the RSS, Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh. It's a fascist outfit. It has more than 6 million members, and their avowed aim is to turn India into an exclusivist Hindu society in which there is absolutely no room for other religious minorities, be they the 200 million Muslims or millions of Christians or even Dalits that constitute something like 200 million people. The BJP, the ruling party, operates at two levels. Number one, by polarizing the population, it believes that it can garner the support of the Hindu majority, which of course it is doing. But at the same time, it is beholden to these extremist groups that want to turn India into an exclusivist Hindu state in which there is no room for minorities, and that is also being pursued. If we look at the record of Modi since he became the Prime Minister in 2014, we see an alarming rise in anti-Muslim attacks in all parts of India, particularly around Delhi, places like Gurgaon and other places. Muslims are not given permission to build mosques. They are being targeted either because there are cow vigilantes who accuse Muslims of slaughtering cows, which is considered a sacred animal in India, or even accusing Muslim vendors, small vendors, of installing their push carts on roadsides, accusing them of blocking traffic, when in fact there are no such allegations or accusations made against Hindus. Mm-hmm. So there are two aspects to this whole campaign. Number one, that Modi and his henchmen have found that polarizing the society garners them support in India because it's a majority Hindu country anyway, and therefore they don't care for the other people. It's not in that sense a true democracy. And number two, there is a very, very strong and dangerous movement in India that wants to turn India into a Hindu state.
Okay.
And that movement is actually supported by the ruling party, and that's the frightening part of it.
All right. Well, Masood, your take. You heard what Zafar said. I mean, it's kind of mind-boggling to think of this country with the size of it. And we're talking about Muslim population over 200 million. If that is the case, if actually Modi or BJP, they really want to turn this into a Hindu nation, I mean, what does that mean? How do they think that that can be accomplished, just looking at the sheer numbers?
It's very dangerous. I'm afraid this has been going on for quite a long time. It's going back even sort of before the new government being sworn in. I mean, in Gujarat, we had under governorship of Modi sort of ethnic cleansing and clashes and massacres of Muslims, which never dealt with appropriately, neither internationally or nationally within India. And this sort of Hindutva movement, which is pushing the idea of otherization and sort of concentrating on demonizing anyone who is not Hindu, it's getting strength. And unfortunately, I have to say that it's out of control. We are not just it, which has been going on and has been going on for a very long time, but we are actually seeing legislation after legislation discriminating against the Muslims in India on censorship and on even saying that any religious group could actually, from the neighboring country, could go to India and get sanctuary, except Muslims.
Right.
And so this exceptionalization against Muslims is going on, and I think international community, and indeed even the Muslim nations, are completely silent to this demonization. And even there are number of token Muslim leaders who's actually part of BJP and promoting this. And also, just to throw in, the situation of Kashmir, which is part of that sort of demonization of Muslims,
right,
and denying them the right, is again very obvious and very clear. Something needs to be done,
okay,
on a matter of urgency.
Well, what about that, Zafar? Masood said that something needs to be done. I want to look at starting inside of the country itself. I mean, India likes to call itself the largest democracy in the world. How did this legislation, for example, the citizenship law, actually pass? I mean, in a country that says it's democratic and then has this very extremist elements that is growing. Tell me about the inside of the country and how this is allowed to happen.
Well, basically, what the BJP is doing is, as you pointed out, that it is enacting laws through parliament because the BJP has a majority in parliament. And this national citizenship law, which they have passed, which basically disenfranchises Muslims, and they can be essentially thrown out of the country. In fact, these are moves going on right now in India, in certain parts of India that they are enacting. Then there are other aspects. In fact, in the Indian constitution, for instance, says that all citizens have equal rights. But as far as the BJP is concerned, it does not believe in this. One of the BJP's leaders, Subramaniam Swamy, was being interviewed by Britain's Channel 4, and she asked him directly and said that your constitution says that all citizens have equal rights, so why are Muslims being persecuted? And Subramaniam Swamy openly said that we do not consider Muslims to be equal to Hindus, and therefore they cannot have equal rights. When you look at this situation, this is absolutely frightening, that they are actually instituting laws to discriminate against Muslims and to consider them as being alien to that country. In fact, these Hindu extremist groups have made absolutely no secret of the fact that the Muslims must either convert to Hinduism or they have to be killed, as this recent meeting of December 17th to 19th that took place in Haridwar in India, and they categorically stated that we need to arm ourselves, that we need to start to kill Muslims, and we need to eliminate these Muslims. And when you look at the fact that Narendra Modi hasn't even uttered a word of condemnation of this, speaks volumes that he is actually encouraging and supporting this kind of attitude and behavior. And I'm afraid if serious action is not taken, first of all by Muslim countries, secondly by the larger international community, I am afraid that there is going to be a genocide of Muslims in India on such a horrendous scale that it will boggle the mind. And I'm afraid this is where it is heading unless immediate action is taken.
Well, let's look at the international aspect to this, Masood. Do you see any action coming from the international community or Muslim communities? You talked about earlier that there is not enough being done. What is being done, and what do you think should be done?
Well, really, nothing positive has been done. I mean, we have seen that some of these Persian Gulf countries like Bahrain and others have actually awarded Modi with the highest award and recognition. It's outrageous that this is happening at the time that so openly, so publicly, so institutionally, Muslims are being demonized and to the extent that the slaughtering of them, it is really becoming very obvious that if nothing is happening, then we are going to see ethnic cleansing and genocide against Muslims. And let us remember that this is going long way back. I mean, colonial power, Britain in particular, were involved in this divide and rule policy, which actually has already once resulted in genocide of hundreds and millions of people in India in the partition time. And now this new ideology and Hindutva is an ideology which is fixed on ethnic cleansing, fixed on supremacy, and fixed on promoting this. And it's been promoted very systematically. Their supporters, the United States, are becoming powerful and lobby. And so I can't see anything is going to happen automatically. We need to bring awareness. And, India is going down a route which I think genocide and ethnic cleansing is just around the corner. Hmm. And I'm not being alarmist. This is actually what is happening. And even the Muslim world and countries are absolutely in daydreaming while this is taking place.
Well, Zafar, we know that India has been getting closer and closer to the Zionist regime, Israel. I mean, when hearing some of the things that you were saying and also Masoud was saying, it was like out of the Israeli playbook, some of the issues that the Muslims are facing now in India. Your assessment of that, do you see any similarities to what is taking place and perhaps Israeli influence in this, or your assessment of that side of things?
Oh, absolutely. The Indian fascists, Hindutva fascists, are actually following the Israeli model completely. What the Zionists are doing to the Palestinian people in Palestine, this is precisely what these Hindutva fascists are doing to Muslims in India, except that the scale is much larger in India, because in India we have at least 200 million Muslims. You know, I would echo exactly what Masoud said, that these anti-Muslim pogroms and riots have been going on since day one of the creation of India. But since the BJP came to power, it has escalated alarmingly, because these fascist groups now have a state at their disposal. And let me give you some examples. For instance, the police force in India, in most parts of India, are infested by these Hindutva fascists. So when Muslims are being targeted, even if they go to lodge a complaint, the police don't pay any attention. You look at the latest example that happened on December 17th to 19th, when a complaint was lodged, although evidence was presented to the police that look at these Hindu fascists that are openly declaring that they should arm themselves and perpetrate a genocide against the Muslims, only one person has been charged out of an entire group of thousands that were involved in that. That gives you an indication of the level of infiltration that has taken place of these fascist elements. The same thing applies to the bureaucracy in India. You go everywhere and you see that today Muslims are, first of all, deprived of their economic rights. Now they're being deprived of their political rights, and they're actually being killed, and very little is being done inside India. So we see that the playbook that the Zionists are following in Palestine, in occupied Palestine, is being repeated in India. I want to add one other point, and that is that India is now considered an ally of the United States and of the West in general, because they want to target China and they want to rope in India on their side. In the United States, there is an organization called the United States Commission for International Religious Freedom. For 2 years in a row, 2020 and 2021, this organization called upon the U.S. State Department to say that India is a country of concern because of religious persecution of minorities, and the State Department should put it on its list. For 2 years in a row, the State Department has categorically refused to do so, claiming and stating that just because India is an ally, that we would not do such a thing. So I'm afraid we are facing a very, very serious situation whereby, regrettably, neither the Muslim countries nor the broader international community is going to do anything about it. And that is why I said that there is a very, very serious risk of a genocide of Muslims taking place in India.
Masoud, you had mentioned Kashmir earlier. And again, when I talk about that comparison between what the Israeli regime is doing, and we look at with Kashmir, that situation, and how at one point in time they were able to keep their land and just other Muslims from the region could, but now Modi, with the law that was passed, actually allows anyone to go in there. And we see an unbelievable crackdown on Kashmir. My question is, do you think there is going to be blowback for all of this inside of India from what is being done in Kashmir, from what is being done inside of India to the minority communities in general, as Zafar had pointed out? The Muslims are 200 million. There are also Christians and others. Do you think that we're going to see some type of reaction from within India, or does pressure have to come from outside?
I think the pressure has to come from outside and inside combined. The reality is that they have, I mean, as I mentioned, Gujarat massacre was exercise to see if they could get away with it. It happened at the time that they weren't in absolute power, but nevertheless, with all the evidence which was there, and we presented extensive reports on it from IHRC, but nothing was done. They got away with it. They're getting away with it in Kashmir, and they're getting away with all these demonization publicly from very high up within the Indian society. They're getting away with it. That is really what makes it very clear that, we are at a very, very dangerous sort of time. Something needs to be done urgently, internationally and nationally. And I'm afraid we can't hold our breath and wait for the OIC to do anything. They've never done anything for anyone. But I think we need to sort of expose what is happening is going to be creating one of the greatest sort of genocide, which has taken place. And unless something will be done urgently, and I emphasize urgently, then we are well already in the way of that genocide, and all the preparation for it, all the tests, and all the situation of Kashmir and the change of the laws against the constitution and so forth, they're all in place for this fascist system to go into the full scale and create that sort of genocide. And we need to really ring the alarm bells all over and ring it in such a way that this sort of genocide, that level in a place like India, is going to be so devastating, not just for Indian Muslims, but for everyone in the region and beyond.
And on that note, I'd like to thank both of you for being with me here on the Spotlight. Zafar Bangash, from the Institute, Director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought out of Toronto, and out of Qesh, lucky you, Masood Shahjadeh, Chairman of Islamic Human Rights Commission. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
As Gabriel Boric's election victory shows, a new hope could be dawning across Latin America. For both the United States government and its Israeli ally, this is not good news, says Alan McLeod, journalist, in an article titled, "The Zionist Regime Freaks Out as Gabriel Boric's Elections Signals New Direction for Chile." Stay tuned for more. If its media is any indication, the Zionist regime is freaking out over the election results in Chile. The Jerusalem Post headline ran, "Anti-Zionist Gabriel Boric's presidential win leaves Chile's Jews worried," going on to explain that the 35-year-old president-elect called Israel a murderous regime and has the firm backing of the country's Palestinian community. Only in the final section of the article did it allude to the fact that Boric's far-right opponent, José Antonio Kast, was the son of a Nazi war criminal who escaped justice by fleeing to South America. The Times of Israel had a similar reaction to the news. Its headline read, "Chile's new president is bitter Israel critic whose win has many local Jews worried." It too glossed over caste background, describing him merely as a right-wing pro-Israel politician whose father was only likely a Nazi. In reality, as the Times of Israel itself has reported only weeks previously, the elder Cass voluntarily joined the Nazi party and was a senior lieutenant in Hitler's war machine. Haaretz was at least more open about who Cass was, however. It treated Boric's opposition to the Israeli regime apartheid as similarly problematic, seemingly equating supporting Palestine to perpetrating the Holocaust. In Chile election, Jews must choose between a Pinochet supporter and an Israel basher, it wrote, explaining that Cass' father was in Wehrmacht. Gabriel Boric demands that Chile's Jews denounce Israel's policies in an election driven more by who they are against than who they are for. The Jewish community is in a bind, unquote. Other outlets, such as Israel Hayom, were similarly concerned by Boric's victory. The Zionist regime did not release any statement. Promising to create a new welfare state and move the country away from the free market capitalist model that has dominated since the days of military dictator Augusto Pinochet, Boric secured a hefty 54% of the vote in the recent election. Dr. Rodrigo Acana, a Chilean-Australian academic who hosts the Indestructible podcast, a show about contemporary Latin American politics, said his politics on several fronts are very progressive and should be commended, adding, "It is, however, Boric's long-standing positions on Palestine that trouble Israeli regime officials. Upon his election to the Chamber of Deputies in 2018, the former student protest leader immediately helped write a bill proposing a boycott of Israeli goods produced in the occupied territories and the Golan Heights. He has been a fervent opponent of the occupation, making several public statements against it, replying to an Israeli embassy social media post claiming that Israeli businesses are offering solutions on how to improve people's lives around the world." He said, "They could start with Palestine, for example, leaving the occupied territory." He also shared a picture of a mural containing a list of slain Palestinian children, writing, "The violence of the occupation is brutal and you pay with your life." Boric has firmly rejected illegal Israeli settlement building. On his official Instagram page, he published a map showing the gradual annexation of Palestine, describing it as a flagrant violation of international norms and human rights. He said, "The Zionist regime violates with impunity all UN resolutions and agreements that have urged it to stop building settlements on Palestinian territory. The violence of the occupation as the powerful countries look to the side, it is brutal. From Chile, we can contribute to change it," unquote. The new president of Chile has also strongly condemned house demolitions, which continue to this day. He asked, "How long will the world allow Israel to humiliate and violate the Palestinian people?" Boric has seen these demolitions and their effects up close. In August 2018, he was part of an official delegation of 11 Chilean parliamentarians who traveled to the occupied Palestinian territories. While there, he visited the cities of Al-Khalil, Beit Lahm, Jericho, Beit Jala, Ramallah, and Tel Aviv. He also wished to go to Gaza, but the Zionist regime authorities blocked him from entering. While in Palestine, he met with representatives of human rights organizations and with President Mahmoud Abbas, who was reportedly heartened by Borek's firm and courageous support to his people's cause. Abbas said the historical relations between our two countries are being strengthened. Just weeks after her release, Borek also made a point of publicly meeting with Ahed Tamimi, a Palestinian child jailed after slapping an Israeli regime troop who invaded her home. She is not a symbol, she is a living fighter for the freedom of Palestine, the Chilean said. Israeli regime officials complained that Tamimi deserved a bullet. Borek was clearly moved by his time in the West Asia region. He reflected, "It is hard to believe the reality of the Israeli occupation of Palestine, the violence and the daily humiliation." Having such a vocal critique of its policies installed as president could pose a number of diplomatic challenges for the Zionist regime and is a problem the administration of Naftali Bennett could live without. Nevertheless, Borek's election triumph was likely not the preferred outcome in Washington and could be understood as part of a broader rising of an anti-establishment politics across the region. Recent elections in Venezuela, Peru, Bolivia, and Honduras have gone to the political left, while Brazil, the largest and most important nation in Latin America, will choose a new president in 2022. Workers' Party candidate Lula da Silva, who was imprisoned with U.S. help as a consequence of the Lava Jato scandal, is far and away ahead in the polls. Throughout 2000s, a wave of radicalism swept across Latin America as country after country elected anti-establishment governments critical of the United States regime. While the Bush and Obama administrations concentrated on the West Asia region, this rebel alliance grew stronger and more vocal. One example of this is on the question of Palestine, with South American nations becoming the state's most committed backers. All over the region, murals showing solidarity with the Palestinian cause can be seen. And while the rest of the world stayed silent, Latin American leaders spoke out about the Zionist regime crimes. After the 2010 attack on the Gaza Freedom Flotilla, then Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez made a public speech declaring the Zionist regime a genocidal regime. He said, "I seize this opportunity one more time. From the bottom of my soul, damn you, Israel, and long live the Palestinian people." This was illustrative of a broader trend across the region. In 2005, not a single South American nation recognized Palestine as an independent state, totally all do. The U.S. Empire struck back in 2010s, organizing or supporting coups across the region and pioneering a new kind of lawfare, using legal means to bring down governments, as happened to Lula in Brazil. It appears, however, that a new hope could be dawning across Latin America. For both the United States regime and its Israeli ally, this is not good news, as it threatens both their economic and geopolitical interests. No wonder the Zionist media are so troubled by Boric's victory.
Beautiful Iran, IRIB English Radio.